series on Abraham's offspring, an introduction to Islam for Christians. Session number 3, surrender, the basic practices of Islam. So again, this is my practice. We'll pause for an invocation. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Alhamdulillah, Rabbil Alameen, Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, most merciful, most compassionate, praise be to God, Lord of the worlds, most merciful, most compassionate. How many have been to one of these sessions before on Islam? Oh, quite a few. Okay, so some of this got some familiar space. Just for those who are new to this, this invocation is the first 3 verses of the first chapter of the Quran, which is the revelation or the scripture of Islam. And I always use it because most people hearing it from a Christian background think, oh, that sounds normal. That sounds like something I could say. Which is to kind of emphasize the commonality that there is, or the family connection that there is between Muslims and Christians. But we need a joke, right, to start with? Jesus decided to go out golfing with Peter one day. And he was really excited because he'd been watching some Tiger Woods videos, instructional videos on golfing. So he went out on the golf course and they're going to make, I don't know anything about golf, so I might use the wrong terminology. But anyways, they were out and they had to make a long drive, right? And he said, oh, watch this. He went up and, you know, he said, I'm going to do it just like Tiger Williams showed me on the video. Tiger Woods, I mean. Yes, there you go, Tiger Woods. Shows you how much you know. Just how Tiger Woods does it. So he lined it up and he hit it and went flying way right into the rough. Oh, they kept playing along. Peter just shook his head, rolled his eyes. They went on a little bit further. And then they came. They were on the green, and he had to putt. And he said, oh, "Watch this! I saw how Tiger Woods did this. I'm going to do it exactly like him." So he lined it up, put way off the hole, went way off off the green itself. Peter just rolls his eyes. He just can't believe that he has to deal with this. Well, they're continuing playing on, and they're kind of slow because Jesus isn't doing all that well. So finally, they come up to another place and have to, you know, hit the ball, and Jesus says, "Oh, watch this! I'm gonna do it just like Tiger Woods does." And he hits the ball and goes flying away right into the middle of a water trout. Peter just rolls his head, and Jesus said, "No, don't worry, I'll get it." And he goes and he walks on the water, you know, down there dipping to get this ball out. Well, this, you know, there's people behind them kind of, you know, they're getting really slow. And one of the party behind them says, you know, asks Peter, who's that guy think he is, Jesus Christ? He says, no, he thinks he's Tiger Woods. Okay. Well, back to Islam. as you know, many of you know, I teach, my name is Volker Greifenhagen, for those of you who haven't been to one of these sessions, and I teach in religious studies at the University of Regina in Regina, Saskatchewan, Canada, at a federated college called Luther College. And the main area I teach in is Islamic studies, and I teach some Hebrew Bible and general courses, comparative religions, survey of all the world religions in one semester type of things. So I have, you know, an academic interest in Islam. I also have a pastoral interest because I'm an ordained pastor of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Canada. And as I've mentioned in all the sessions so far, I think it's important for Christians to be aware of Islam. Because of Islam, the numbers of Muslims in the world, it's the second largest religion in the world, and it's growing the fastest in the world. And for instance, in North America, Islam will very soon be the next biggest religion after Christianity. It will outstrip the numbers of Jews in North America, for instance. So Muslims are neighbors, not just far away in other countries, but, you know, the mosque could be next door, or your neighbor could be a Muslim. So that's very important to know about your neighbors and to understand where they're coming from. Islam is also prominent in world affairs. you hear a lot of negative, largely negative reporting about Muslims in the news. Often Islam is associated with things like violence and or the oppression of women. Those are the two big things. And so it's really important to understand that, because it's tempting to paint a whole religion and a whole group of people in a very negative fashion, because the media seems to, you know, shapes our perceptions that way. Is that true or not? We should ask that question. But probably the most important reason for us knowing something about Islam is because Muslims are distant cousins or members of the family. They also trace their ancestry spiritually back, just as Jews and Christians do, to Abraham. And so, you know, how often in families, that's where you have the worst disagreements. You don't get along, you don't talk to one another, and you have feuds and things like that. Well, that's been, unfortunately, part of the history of Islam and Christianity. And maybe it's time to reconcile with some estranged members of the family. So one of the ways is to learn more about these members of the family. So today, what I'd like to do is talk about what do Muslims do. We talked about stereotypes the first day, talked about what Muslims believe yesterday, but I also sort of indicated yesterday that for Muslims, how you practice your faith or what you have to be able to practice your faith is really important. So we'll talk about practices today. And I have to be here with this overhead, so I'm not turning my back on anybody, intentionally at least, okay? So if that's okay. Now, just to give you a little a bit of a kind of reiterate a little bit from yesterday, but get us into today's topic. Here's the greeting that we learned yesterday, a common Muslim greeting. Some of you know this. Let's try this again. I would greet you by saying Salam Alaikum, and you would say? Right. And what are you saying? What are we saying to each other? What are we greeting each other with when we do this? Okay, but more literally, we're saying peace, right? Peace, okay? Salam is peace. It's like shalom in Hebrew. It means peace be to you, and the response is, and to you, peace. And we learned last day that the word, you see the words, the consonants in peace are S-L-M. And Arabic, like Hebrew, is a language in which all the words are built on triconsonantal roots, or most of them are. So you have three consonants, and you add different vowels and consonants, and you get different related words. Well, if you look at the word Islam, you'll see that Islam also is a word based on SL, so it's related to the word for peace. And, you know, this is sort of review. Here we have the words shalom and salam, and you can see that in Arabic, the root is a verb, SLM, that means on the one hand to submit or surrender, and on the other hand to make peace or to have peace. All right? So Islam is a noun describing the action of submitting one's will to God, implied, in order to enjoy peace. And peace meaning not just absence of conflict, but wholeness, prosperity, health, life as it's meant to be enjoyed. All right? And a person who practices this is a Muslim. All right? So, how can, if you were a Muslim, how could you be helped to practice Islam? How could you be helped to do this? Another thing that we learned last day was what, let's see, those of you who were there, whether you remember this, what is sort of the central overriding belief of Muslims? What would be the central affirmation?
One God.
Oneness of God, right? One God, a very strict monotheism. And I didn't put this up for you last time, but it'll do as review. This doctrine is called the doctrine of Tawheed. I had a hard doing this backwards. Okay, Tawheed, which comes from the word for Wahid, one, and it means the absoluteness, the unity, and the uniqueness of God. Nothing is comparable to God. You can't put anything in God's place. You can't split divinity up into different aspects that are here, there, and it's God is one unique absolute. And it's to this God that one surrenders one's self, one's will, in order to enjoy life as God, this God intended it to be. The opposite of Tawheed, and the worst thing you can do as a Muslim, is to commit shirk. And shirk is to associate anything with God. In other words, to make absolute something that is relative, to commit idolatry. Now, this doesn't just mean, idolatry in sort of the sense that you set up an idol or something like that. It can mean putting anything in the place of God. If you make highest in your hierarchy the pursuit of education or of wealth, you're making it your God, and then you're committing shirk, because you're making absolute something which is relative. If you put yourself first, you're committing shirk. You're making absolute something that is relative. Right? So that's the kind of the central concern. So what Muslims strive for, and this is the last, you know, these are all Arabic terms, and my students always gross about all the Arabic they have to learn, but this is common language for Muslims. They talk this language all the time. They know immediately what they mean. What they strive for is what they call taqwa, and a good a translation of that is God consciousness at all times. In other words, it's the piety which comes from the awe of God. Sometimes it's translated the fear of God. But we had a sort of discussion in Bible study about the fear of God this morning, that it's not necessarily, it often in biblically means more awe of God and not so much cringing and everything, but being really aware of the immensity of God and of God's control and of God's being the source from which we come. So this kind of awareness is what Muslims will try to engender constantly in everyday life. Now what I'm going to talk about are five practices that are sort of mandatory for Muslims. In other words, a good practicing Muslim will try to engage in these five practices. And what these five practices are meant to do is to help train oneself or discipline oneself to be God conscious. Okay, so it's not just kind of be God conscious, be full of God consciousness. Well, however, you can do it, and then you're kind of going, oh, how am I going to do this? Well, maybe I'll meditate, or I don't know, maybe I'll study the scripture. No, it's kind of, no, here are some very specific ways that you can work on this, and that the community works together, the Muslim community all does this together. So you're working together to be, to have taqwa, to have God consciousness, all right? And often these things they're not just verbal things, they also involve actions, actual things that you do. So that's what I'm going to go through briefly today. I'm going to put a little chart up which will show you what they are. They're often called the five pillars of Islamic practice. So here's a cute little diagram with five pillars. And as usual, they all have Arabic names again, but we've got an indication of what they are under here. But the five things are, and I'll just go through them, just give the names of them now, and then we'll look at each one of them in a little bit more detail. And please feel free to ask questions about any of them along the way. What I intend to do is to go through each of them. And then I have a video of the pilgrimage to Mecca, of which I will have about a 10-minute segment that I want to show. If we have time, we can see. Yep.
Would you please move those up? It's very hard to see.
Okay.
Let
me see if I can do that without crashing this thing.
You move it up to the top.
Oh, move this up. Yeah. I see. Okay. I thought you wanted this higher. Okay. How's that?
Great. Thank you.
Okay. So the five things that you see there are, first of all, the Shahada, Now, boy, that should be familiar to those of you here last yesterday, right? This is the profession or the confession of faith. Then is something called salat. This is prayer, formal kind of prayer, and it is to be engaged in 5 times a day. Zakat, which it refers to a welfare contribution or charity, right? Saum, which means fasting, and it's fasting during a particular time of the year, Ramadan. And Hajj, which refers to the pilgrimage to Mecca. So I'm just going to go through each of them, explain a little bit about each of them. Please interrupt me with your questions as you go along. But again, the main thing you want to remember about these is these are not so much meant to be sort of requirements that you have to fulfill in order, you know, to be in the club. They are practices that you are invited to engage in quite willingly because they will help you to be God conscious. Okay, they will provide you with the discipline to put God first. They will provide you with the example and the actual training to submitting your will to God so that it becomes more and more of a natural thing in your life. That's the intent behind these things. All right. So first of all is the Shahada, and this is one that a few folks from yesterday will have already seen. Okay. Shahada meaning a witness. This is sort of the minimal statement of belief of Muslims. Very simply, La ilaha illallah, there is no God but God. That's the first part of it. And secondly, Wa Muhammad Rasulullah. And Muhammad is the messenger of God. Again, this very simple statement, if one recites it, believing in it, and it's witnessed, and one intends to then engage in a Muslim lifestyle, is what makes one a Muslim. Right? And in fact, you know, I have Muslim students in my classes, and they practice to varying extents, just like, you know, our young people, or people in general, Christians, will practice to a greater or lesser extent. Still think they're Christian, right? Some of my Muslim students say, well, this is the really important thing. I believe this and say this, and I don't pray all the time, but at least I say this, and therefore I think I'm being a good Muslim as far as I can be, all right? So this is really quite central, this witness to the faith. And that one, it's repeated in the call to prayer every day, it's repeated in conversation. It's a very central kind of definitive aspect of Muslim faith. In fact, yesterday I said it sort of functions as a symbol for Islam, a verbal symbol that would be analogous to the symbol of the cross in Christianity, which is a visual symbol. This functions as sort of a defining verbal symbol. There is no God but God, strict monotheism, and Muhammad is the messenger of God who made this known to us. Okay, so we believe, Muslims would say, we believe the message from God as it was revealed through Muhammad. Muhammad not seen as some sort of divine being or anything, but seen as the vehicle, the human vehicle that God used, the prophet that God used to bring another message to humanity. All right? Any questions on the Shahada? It's pretty straightforward. And like I said yesterday, probably Christians would have no trouble with the first part of that creed, or Jews wouldn't. There's no God but God. Where we sort of diverge is that Christians and Jews don't accept, generally at least, that Muhammad is a messenger of God. Whereas Muslims, of course, will accept, they accept Jesus and Moses and everybody else, Noah and so on, as being messengers from God.
I have a question that's not related to this. You keep bringing up the Arabic.
Yes.
Is Arabic inextricably linked with Islam?
Yes and no. How's that? Is that a good answer? It is not in the sense that most Muslims in the world don't speak Arabic.
Right.
Like only 20% of Muslims are of Arabic origin and speak Arabic in their day-to-day conversation. So in that sense, it isn't. Islam is an international religion and covers all different kind of cultures and languages, right? Yes, in the sense that the Quran, the scriptures of Islam, are in Arabic. They were revealed, Muslims believe, through Muhammad, who was an Arabic-speaking Arab in the Arabian Peninsula. So they were in Arabic. And Muslims believe that the Quran, when it is recited properly, when you hear it, you hear the voice of God. Literally. It is the literal voice of God. Okay? Now, they recognize, as well as anybody else, that as soon as you translate something, there's an inevitable loss in translation. Okay? So they have taken the tact of maintaining the Arabic, at least as far as the language of scripture and prayer goes. Okay, and so, and then a lot of terms, of course, become part of whatever language. They come from Arabic and they come part of English or part of Urdu or whatever. So the Arabic has tended to remain important for that particular reason, because it's the language in which the revelation came, and it wants to, they want to maintain it. Christianity kind of took the other tact of translation into all kinds of languages. First into Latin, of course, and then into a multitude of languages. So nobody, no Christians really, I mean, probably very few of you know any Hebrew or Greek, right? Whereas a lot of Muslims will know at least a little bit of Arabic. Okay, let's go on to the next one. Let's put this back up so I can see what order we're going to go in. Oh, okay, Salat. Prayer 5 times a day. Okay. Here's a little handy chart if you want to know. Oh, I have to do everything opposite. Okay. This has a number of informative things on it, but the 5 daily prayer times are listed there on the column to your right. Prayer at dawn, prayer at noon, prayer sort of mid-afternoon, prayer at sunset, and evening prayer. Okay. There's a very interesting story told about the times for prayer. One of the experiences that Muhammad is said to have had, it's only alluded to in the Quran, but in Muslim tradition it's been fleshed out quite a bit, is that he was miraculously transported from Mecca to Jerusalem, to the Temple Mount. Now, the mystics in Islam make a lot out of this because they see this as a paradigm of the mystical journey. And I was on a mystic beast, kind of a miraculous beast with wings and all kinds of stuff. He's brought to the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, and from the Temple Mount, he ascended to the various heavens, the various layers of heaven, right? And met all the prophets, met Jesus and Moses and so on, until he went to the highest heaven and was given a vision of God, okay? And apparently God, at that time, told him, something like, well, I want people to pray 50 times a day. And Muhammad said yes, and went down, and on the way down he encountered Moses, and Moses said, what did God tell you? And he said, well, today people have to pray 50 times a day. Moses said, that's way too many. Go back up and ask him to reduce it. And so Muhammad did, and I mean, this is all sort of apocryphal, and so I mean, Orthodox Muslims might be aghast at this, but you know, they could deal with it, eh? So he went up and asked, and it was reduced, like maybe to 30 or whatever. Came down, most, still too many, up you go, and until he finally got it reduced to 5, and when he came down, Moses said, well, that's still too many. And Muhammad said, no way, I'm not going up again. I'm not going to reduce it anymore. So that's kind of a more of an amusing thing. But
not amusing when you're visiting one of those Muslim countries and someone from the minaret is
calling
out on a loudspeaker, and then from another minaret there are about 5 loudspeakers blasting away at you at the same time.
That's right, yeah, calling people to prayer, yeah. That's a good way to set your watch, though. I don't know what time it is. Okay, but it is coordinated to the sun, though. I mean, very clearly. So the times change somewhat during the year because the dawn prayer is just before. It's still dark. It's before sunrise. The noon prayer is actually at noon, whenever the sun is actually at the zenith, and so on. So it'll also, the time prayer times will sort of vary where you are in the world too, and whether it's winter or summer, and so on. But there's 5 prayer times. Now these prayers don't take long. They consist of a variety of a number of cycles of prayer that include both set phrases and set postures. Okay. This is not spontaneous prayer. This is not me, like me sitting down saying, okay, I'm going to pray now, dear God, take care of my family, and sort of, you know, praying like a conversation. This is liturgical prayer. It's set prayer, okay? This kind of prayer where you pray, you know, spontaneously to God also happens. Muslims also engage in that, but it's not salat. It's not the liturgical prayer. It's not the required canonical or liturgical prayer. Here you can see the sequence of actions or postures that are engaged in each cycle. It begins with a standing posture down, a profound bow from the waist standing, then a complete prostration right to the ground, a kneeling, and then if you go into another cycle, you'd be standing up again. Okay, so it's very active physically. And it's actually very healthy. There have been some physicians who have done some studies on, you know, somebody who is a devout Muslim and does this actually 5 times a day. It's actually like a little exercise routine, 5 times a day. Okay, I'm not trying to be facetious, but what is happening here is that you are not only saying, okay, I need to submit my will to God, and you're thinking about it intellectually. You're enacting it with your body. You're doing it not only with your mind or your thoughts or what's inside you, but you're actually doing it with your body. You're actually going right down. I mean, you know, that's a submissive posture right there. Right down to the ground. Okay? So I think that's an important thing. This is not foreign to Christianity either, especially in some of the Eastern Orthodox forms of Christianity. This kind of prayer posture is adopted. When I visited the Taizé community in France, they, in certain of the prayer services, also use this posture because it's like physically, you know, enacting that submission.
Is this similar to the synagogues where it's men only and women do it at a separate place and the women do it?
It varies. It varies a lot. In some parts of the Muslim world, women are discouraged from going to the mosque because it's public space. In many parts of the Muslim world, women come to the mosque, but they pray separately from men. Either they pray in a separate room, they pray separated with a curtain, or they pray, you know, in separate areas of the same. Sometimes a veil, sometimes not. Very rarely do women actually mix with men when they're praying. In fact, that's probably not considered, that's kind of considered heterodox, right?
Do they do this facing the center direction?
Yes, okay, that's a good point. There's a number of cycles, they take about 5 minutes. Okay, so, you know, 5 to 10 minutes you're taking out of your day 5 times a day to remind yourself that God's really in charge in that.
Plus they have to get there.
Well,
a lot of times they did go to the mosque.
If you have a mosque, but these prayers can be done anywhere, as long as it's a relatively clean place. And many Muslims can't get, like I'm thinking more of the North American situation where there isn't a mosque around the corner. You do it in your office, you do it beside your machine at work. It doesn't matter, you don't have to. There's sort of a encouragement to come to a mosque if you can to pray together. Especially for the Friday noon prayer. That's the congregational prayer. Because it not only includes prayer cycles, but it also includes a sermon. Okay, so that's where everybody's encouraged to come at Friday for noon prayer.
Women too?
Well, again, that varies, again, between different countries. Those countries where women are, you know, go to the mosque regularly, yes. Those countries where they're sort of expected to stay at home, no. It really is varied. That you can't say there's one way doing things. Now, you mentioned the direction of prayer. It was a very interesting thing. Muslims orient themselves to one single point on the earth's surface when they pray, and that is Mecca. Because in Mecca, there is a cube-like structure called the Kaaba, which was sort of the mosque that Muhammad adopted in the time when he lived. And since that time, Muslims have always oriented themselves to that particular occasion. So wherever you are, you got to figure out where's the direction of Mecca? And I have no idea from Houghton Village where it would be, except it would probably be somewhat east and southerly, probably, right? You'd have to figure it out. Now, why is that? It's not because God lives in Mecca. Okay, I mean, that's considered God's house in a sense, more of a, in a symbolic sense. It is to show the unity of the Muslim community, okay, that they all face the same place. And so whenever you as a Muslim, whenever a Muslim is praying, a Muslim can say, I'm praying together with all my brothers and sisters, where I'm doing it together with them. The unity is also emphasized when these postures are done. It's not just everybody sort of doing them at their own pace, you know, like I come and I start it and then you come in. No, there's a prayer leader, an imam. Imam, that steps forward and does the prayers in front, and everybody follows his postures so that they time it together, so that the bows and the prostrations are all done in unity as much as possible. Various Quranic phrases and prayers are said during the prayers. There are usually certain set phrases that are said. Allahu Akbar is one of them, which means God is the greatest. The Fatiha, which is the opening surah or chapter of the Quran, of which we heard a few verses at the beginning, is one of them. And various other prayers are said, depending which of the prayer times it is. At some of the prayer times, these things are said aloud. Sometimes they're just said internally, like people whisper them in their heads.
These are all memorized, is that correct?
Yes.
And do they start your children?
Yes. Yeah, there's a great stress on memory. The Quran itself, the scripture of Islam, is about as long as the New Testament, and there are countless Muslims who have memorized the whole thing in Arabic. So imagine memorizing the New Testament in Greek, okay, not in English, but in Greek, and can recite it. I mean, this is counted as a real badge of honor in Islam. In fact, they have Quranic recitation contests, like essay writing contests for kids. Instead, it will be who's learned to recite the Quran the most eloquently, the best, and has the best memory, and there'll be school competitions. So, like, reach for the top, like, you know, you go to the next level of competition in some countries until you become sort of the champion Quran reciter. So there's a great stress still on orality, you know, on memorizing things and that sort of stuff. So kids, if they go to Quran school, they don't go so much, at least at the beginning, to discuss the meaning of the Quran, but they go to learn to recite it and memorize it. And then I'll get to you.
Okay, the significance of washing, of being clean.
Right, okay, that's another. What do you need in order to pray? Well, you need just a place. You need to know what direction is Mecca approximately, and you need to wash beforehand. Okay, ablutions are one of the requirements for prayer. This involves washing the hands all the way up to the elbows, washing the feet, and running water over your hair and over your face and behind your ears and your neck. So there's a kind of a very experienced Muslims can do this really quickly. Okay.
Well, we were very thankful for this particular practice when we were wandering around Istanbul, and we could always find a place.
Always
by the way.
Yep.
Both directions at a mosque.
Yeah. That's why mosques typically have a courtyard in which there's a fountain, especially in the, you know, Middle Eastern countries and so on, where it's warm. People will come, they'll take off, but the other thing is you take off your shoes before you go into a mosque. Take off your shoes, then wash at the fountain. And in you go to the mosque to do your prayers. There's no pews. It's just a big carpeted space because that's what you do your prayers on. All right. The only kind of ornament that there might be, besides maybe calligraphy on the walls, is there'll be a niche, a little indentation in one of the walls to indicate that's the direction of Mecca. And there might be a pulpit off to the side, which is used for the prayer, for the sermon on the Friday noon prayer. So usually a mosque is a vast, if they're big mosques, they're just a vast expanse, kind of extraordinary, not cluttered at all. It's just this big thing with carpets and a high ceiling and then sort of a direction indicated.
Yeah.
Did they make any effort to orient the mosque towards Mecca?
Yes, yeah.
Just in order to facilitate?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, they're all built, and obviously. Now, the mosque in Regina, where I am, it used to be a Lutheran church. And so, of course, it's not oriented the right way. So it's very interesting. The room goes this way, and they put tape on the floor, sort of diagonal, and everybody sort of lines up towards the corner, because that's the direction. I know you had a question back there.
I want to ask if non-Muslims are welcome.
Usually, yes. Some countries not. Like in North Africa, it was sort of like in Morocco and some of those countries, it was practiced not. And I think it came from colonial experience there. Whereas I think like in Egypt and, well, in Israel or Palestine where I was, I mean, there wasn't a problem. At least the time I was there, there was no problem. And in North America, there definitely usually is no problem. It's like, you know, it's good to check ahead of time. But usually there isn't a problem of non-Muslims coming. It's good to, I mean, it's a good thing. I mean, it's really interesting to see. Usually most Islamic centers in North America are eager to let non-Muslims know what they do, that they're not kind of doing some weird things in there or some unspeakable atrocities or something. And they're eager to kind of explain what their faith is about. So, you know, you just call up and say you'd like to, and they'll let you. You just sit at the back and you can sort of observe the prayer and see what happens. Yeah.
I wonder, does Islam emphasize evangelizing or proselytizing?
Yes. Yes. It, along with Christianity and Buddhism, are the three missionary religions that emphasize spreading the word in one way or the other.
Westerners have obviously emphasized proselytizing in other
countries,
parts of the world, but has Islam made attempts to make into...
Oh, yeah, there's proselytization in North America, you know, funded by oil money and, you know, distribution of Qurans and all that sort of stuff all Muslims are encouraged to witness, you know, in the sense of to their faith by making it very clear in public that they are Muslim. And when there's questions about that, explaining why. So, I mean, it'd be sort of the same thing that Christians and Buddhists were also are usually encouraged to do as well. Yeah?
Does an imam have more to do than just lead the prayers? I mean, does the imam also take on pastoral
things? The word just means leader, yeah. And it can be any pious Muslim who the community says, okay, you, but in the family, when Muslims, like, you know, you might not get to the mosque for a lot of these prayers, and you pray them at home with your family. Let's say, well, who's the imam there? Well, one of the parents. That's one of the few times that a woman can be the imam, is in the home. Okay? So it can be anyone who steps out. Now, a lot of big mosques have sort of an established position, sort of like, you know, the priest of a church or pastor of a church. And this will be the imam at a mosque, at a big mosque, will be the one who will generally lead the prayers, who will preach the sermon on Sunday, and will, well, it's interesting. They haven't traditionally kind of functioned in that kind of more pastoral way in other countries, but in North America, the office of imam starts, you know, hospital visitation, prison ministry, counseling, all that stuff is becoming part of the kind of running, the, you know, make sure the school, that the, well, often it's run on Sundays because that's when people have the time to have their kids in the mosque school. Making sure all that runs has become the responsibility of the imam. It's Islam adapting itself to North American patterns of doing things, yeah.
You mentioned women's limited role, and we Westerners hear quite a bit about women being real subjugated, especially mm-hmm. the fundamentalist strains. And is that historically dating back to Muhammad Ben, the role that Islam has held for women, this limited role, or is that a newer phenomenon?
Well, I'll tell you what a progressive Muslim would say, okay? Now, and you can evaluate, you know, I mean, obviously, it's very diverse kind of phenomenon. Most people think Islam is one thing and that's all. But let's say, for instance, the covering or the veiling of women. You find everything from totally no veiling in the Muslim world to total, not just veiling the head or the hair, to total body covering and everything in between. So there's no kind of uniform practice. The progressive Muslim would say, that at the time of Muhammad, the place of women was generally not good. Women were largely seen as chattels. A father would see his daughters as an investment. He'd see if he could marry her off to someone that they could get a big bride price. Basically, you'd sell your daughter, you know, for getting a good bride price and for getting a good alliance with another rich family or something. And the progressive Muslim would say that Muhammad changed a lot of that. For instance, he abolished the bride price, and in fact, the gift, the groom is required to give a dowry to the bride. That's Islamic practice, but it remains the bride's. He can't touch it. He also cannot touch any of the wealth that she brings into the marriage on her own. That's her money, and technically, now there are lots of ways throughout history that men have found ways to get around these things, right? Technically, he can't touch it, okay? Men married all kinds of women, lots of women, had many different wives. Muhammad restricted it to four, okay? I mean, that can be seen as a restriction, all right? And things like that, the female infanticide was practiced widely in the Arabian Peninsula at the time of Muhammad, because daughters, unless you could get them, you know, married off, they were not seen as being worthwhile as boys. You wanted a son, so they'd often bury daughters in the sand or kill them off, and that was absolutely wrong, okay, and he forbade that. So the progressive Muslim would say that actually Muhammad brought about quite a revolution in women's rights. What happened is that as Islam expanded and then made contact with the Persian Empire and the Byzantine Empire, who had practices of secluding and veiling women, and these were Zoroastrian and Christian empires, what we don't realize is that the high-class women often were veiled in public. And so if you want to pretend you were high class, you veiled, right? Okay? Or were secluded. They didn't go out into public very much, okay? That was then adopted by the elite in Islam and then filtered its way down to the masses. And so the progressive Muslim might say, well, and then patriarchy took over, as it did in all the other religions, and kind of messed things up and distorted them. And now we're going to try to get back to the roots. So there are Muslims today like Amina Wakhdud Musin and Rifat Hassan and others. These are two that I just mentioned. They live in the States and are going back to the sources. And they're sort of the intellectuals of the Islamic feminist movement.
Are they women?
Yes. Yeah, they're both women that I mentioned. Yeah. They're women that are, because they say education is a right. And they can prove it on the basis of sayings of Muhammad and so on. And we're going to examine the Quran for ourselves and decide whether the rules are right or not.
Would the most progressive elements of Islam then hold women equal?
Yes.
To men completely without
yes.
any of these?
Yeah, they would say they would see equal. Now, they would stress that men and women, that because of their gender, may have different roles that they fulfill. And of course, that always gets you into a little bit of a shaky ground, because that's often sort of an opening to slip inequality in. But they would try really hard to maintain, that their roles, but they're still equality. They want to. So Muslim feminists want that family is really important to them, and so they really strong stress on the family. Yeah.
I think too that they have rules about how you take a second wife.
Oh, yes. Oh, okay. Yeah, that whole thing.
There's
yeah.
much worse things in this world. One than arranged marriages. We knew a couple in Sudan, and his father had two wives.
Right.
And the one was somewhat younger than the other one. And he had introduced them and asked the first one if it was okay.
Uh-huh.
And she came along, and of course, she started having children, and the other one was older, so she helped her take care of them.
Right.
And he complained. He said they ganged up on him.
Yeah, and see, in the domestic sphere, he has no right to dictate things.
Yeah.
You see, they're in charge of that. Yeah, yeah. That most Muslims do not have more than one wife. I should dispel that stereotype right away, because you can't afford to have more. Like every wife, a Muslim man is required to fully support if she wants it. A Muslim wife, his wife, and his wives, if there are more than, in exactly the same manner. In fact, one of the verses in the Quran says, of them, equally. And some Muslims say, well, that's impossible, so therefore there's an implicit argument against polygamy right there. And they would say, you know, at the time of Muhammad, there were a lot of widows because of the warfare that was going on. And the best form of social welfare at the time for widows and orphans was to be connected into a family. So it was, a man might have a wife and he'd marry another one to take care of her orphan children and everything like that. And mom said, you know, encourage that, just don't do more than four. And some progressive Muslims say, well, that was a time-bound a thing. Nowadays, it's we have other ways of taking care of widows and orphans, and it's not necessary. And besides, how can you equally love and care and cherish for more than one wife?
Didn't the ancient Jews do the same thing? Take in a brother's wife?
Yes, yeah. Now, that's levirate marriage, which is more specific, but it's the same idea of... Well, there it was also the concern for carrying on the brother's name. But, I mean, this shouldn't be surprising. I mean, how many wives did Solomon and David and all our heroes have, eh? Way more than this paltry four. Come on. So, and it's, there is no injunction against polygamy in the New Testament either. I mean, bishops are supposed to have one wife. But, you know, we're not, most of us aren't bishops, so we should be really
Can I ask a really fundamental question?
Yeah.
You said they trace their roots back to Abraham.
Yeah.
Is Allah then the God of Abraham?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, God, Allah is the generic word. It just means God, really.
Okay.
Okay, so Arabic Christians say, you know, when they're talking in Arabic or worshiping in Arabic, we pray to Allah.
Okay.
And it's very clear, Muslims are very clear that the same God who was revealed to the Jews and to the Christians is the same God that spoke through Muhammad. They're not seen as separate gods at all. Now, I had a big argument with some church people in the interior of British Columbia about this, they were convinced that, I mean, they were very anti-Islamic, and they thought Allah was just a different God completely. They couldn't be convinced of it. But it was, for me, it's like you say Dieu in French, or you say Gott in German, or whatever language. It's, you know, it's just the word for God.
Sure.
Okay, anything else about prayer? Prayer's really, really quite central, okay? And again, what I like to emphasize is just that the whole combination of words and physical actions are meant as a discipline to remind you who's number one in your life. Okay? God is number one. The fact that you will take out that 5 or 10 minutes 5 times during the day, and sometimes for dawn prayer, like you have to get up pretty early, eh? And you'll go to bed often after that, but you have to, you know, set your alarm and get up and do your prayer.
You don't need to set an alarm.
Well, in North America, you do, you know. I mean, I heard one convert to Islam was telling, he described in his book how hard that was for him. He used this because he just couldn't get up, and he'd set an alarm on the floor halfway to the bathroom, another alarm near the door to the bathroom, because he'd wake up first, and he'd sort of fall out of bed and fall asleep again. Then the next alarm would go off, and kind of crawl a little bit further, and finally, by the third alarm at the bathroom, he was awake enough to quickly, you know, do the washing and do his prayers, you know. So, you know, he had to really train himself to submit his will to God, to God's will, you might say. Okay. Now, what was the next one here? The next one I think we can do a little bit quickly here. Zakat, that's the welfare contribution. Zakat actually means purification. And it's a means of purifying your material wealth. What it is, you know, its quickest, shortest form is that Muslims should contribute 2.5% of their total earnings and assets in any given year to charity. 2.5%, not just of what you earn, but what your worth is, your net assets and worth, okay? 2.5% every year. And where is this supposed to go to? Well, to help poor people, to help travelers, to help in the propagation of Islam, to support mosques and hospitals and schools and whatever. Well, what this is seen is, you know, this social welfare aspect built into Islam, that you take care of other members of the community, okay? And that purifies the rest of your wealth to be used for yourself, okay? Then it's okay. Now this is very complicated. I gave 2.5% of your total assets as sort of a ballpark figure. The laws for this were elaborated back in ancient times when people's wealth wasn't in stocks and bonds and stuff like that. It wasn't how many camels you had and how much land you had. So the actual rules are: if you have so many camels, you owe this much. If you have this much wheat, you know, it's this much. And the Muslims are really kind of trying to figure out how do you translate that all into modern terms. So generally, 2.5% is sort of the figure that you come to. Now, there's no, in North America, there aren't any real set channels for how you do that. Most Muslims figure it out by themselves or get help figuring it out, and they contribute to what they choose. There are zakat organizations in North America that will channel the money to worthwhile Muslim causes, and some Muslims, a lot of Muslims will make use of those. Others will just, you know, the United Way or whatever will do. So they'll do that. Okay.
In the process of channeling their contributions, what kind of an organizational system do they have?
They don't.
Each mosque is independent?
In North America, it's very disparately organized. A lot of mosques are generally fairly independent. Some are part of various Islamic associations and have sort of a tighter network. And some of those networks will include ways to deal with zakat. But basically, my impression is, at least of North American Muslims, and actually probably in many other parts of the Muslim world, it's up to the individual Muslim person to make his or her own decisions about that and channel the money in various ways as they see fit. Psalm is the second last one. This is fasting during Ramadan. Ramadan is the 9th month of the Muslim year. And what one is to do during that month is to have nothing to eat or drink in daylight hours. So from just before sunup to just after sundown, one doesn't drink anything, one doesn't smoke, one doesn't eat, one doesn't engage in sexual intercourse, anything like that. Okay. Now all Muslims all around the world do this during the same month. Right? Why? Well, it's a way of disciplining your will, okay, of learning how to submit your will to God's will. It's a way of learning what it means to be hungry, so to engender a desire to help those out who aren't hungry. It's a way of engendering solidarity of the community. You know that all good Muslims, practicing Muslims, are kind of feeling that same real tight stomach at the same time you are. So it's not just you yourself doing your own fast.
And ready to celebrate when it's dark.
Well, and that's the other thing that's very interesting. Most people, you know, if I said, okay, this month, we're all gonna fast during daylight hours, I'm just like, oh no, it's gonna be horrible. What an awful experience. Muslims look forward to Ramadan because as soon as, of course, the sun sets, it's okay to eat. And actually, a lot of Muslims overeat during that time because all the festive foods come out. It's sort of like Christmas, right? Where there's sort of baking and stuff that you only do for Christmas. Well, during Ramadan, all these special Ramadan foods come out. And people really don't get a whole lot of sleep because they spend a lot of time in festivities during Ramadan. They visit and they're out in the street celebrating. Some of you saw that picture, the poster I had of Mickey Mouse celebrating Ramadan with his candle, and you know, that's at night because, you know, you need a light, and that's what happens. There's a lot of entertainment, festivities, a lot of visiting during this month.
My husband has a Saudi prince who's one of his patients, mm-hmm. who comes every July and August.
Right.
And he had dental work that had to be done.
Yes.
And I know with Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah, when if Jews have if they have a medical problem, they're basically permitted to eat.
Yes, yes.
And he had a dental problem, but he basically put it off of Ramadan and the fact that he was not, he didn't want to have dental work done, even though he was going to eat, but he didn't want any dental work done. I just thought, is that standard? I mean, that medical ailments, do they tend to defer, you know?
Yep. All of these things are to be engaged in if you're able. I mean, there are exceptions to all of them, okay? So for instance, this fasting during Ramadan, if you're pregnant, forget it.
Or children.
You know, or children aren't required to do any of these things, the prayers, and of course, well, they're not making money, so the welfare contribution and so on. But there's a very lenient system, okay? If you're traveling, fasting during, while you're traveling, especially back then, it wasn't a very good thing, so you didn't travel. Now, what happened is that you were encouraged to make it up at another time. So let's say you couldn't fast during the actual month of Ramadan. Well, you might try fasting a different month. It wouldn't be the same thing because you'd be kind of by yourself. But there was that flexibility built in. If you can't pray at that time of day because it's just impossible, well, pray a little bit later or combine two of the prayers together. You know, there's that kind of flexibility. Now, he could have, if it was serious enough, I mean, you know, it was his decision. If it was serious enough, he could have, there wouldn't have been any problem with him saying, I have to eat during this time, I need this medical procedure, and I will either fast at another time or just forego it because you don't threaten life or health through these practices, okay? He obviously decided it wasn't strict emergency enough for him, yeah. So he deferred the medical procedure. And,
Is there a coming of age for the boys?
Puberty. Puberty is...
Do they have a ceremony or anything?
Circumcision is practiced in Muslim communities. And in some Muslim communities, it's done when you're older. Like when you're 8 or 9. And that would be like a coming of age ceremony. And a lot of others, it isn't. It really varies. So that, if anything, would be a coming of age ceremony. Mainly the children... Usually when they reach puberty is when some of these things start, you know, they're starting to be then actively encouraged to do them. A lot of kids pick it up. I mean, their parents are doing these things all the time, and they just want to do what mom and dad do or what the other people in the mosque are doing. So you find little kids sprinkled amongst their parents during the prayers, and sometimes they're laughing and running around, you know, kind of being disruptive. But a lot of times they're, you know, kind of copying what's happening. But by the time they reach puberty is usually when. But there's no usually, there might be, but they'd be more cultural kind of ceremonies, not really, you know, Islamically necessitated ceremonies of coming of age. Okay, so fasting is during the month of Ramadan, again, 30 days or 29 days, depending on how long the moon phases go. You know that, of course, the Islamic calendar is a lunar calendar. No, you didn't probably know that, of course. Okay, so it's out of sync with the solar calendar. Our solar calendar is 365 days long, based on how long it takes the Earth to go around the sun once. A lunar calendar is about 11 days shorter. Because 12 phases of the moon taking between 29 and 30 days each doesn't add up to 365. So for their liturgical purposes, if you will, or religious purposes, Muslims follow a strict lunar calendar. That means they go through a year 11 days quicker than we do. So Ramadan will not be at the same time of year. Instead, it'll be 11 days earlier each year. So it kind of moves throughout all the seasons. I think it takes about 30 or 40 years of our solar years for Ramadan to go through the cycle of seasons. So if you want to do Ramadan, start by doing Ramadan in the winter. Why?
Short day.
The days are shorter in the winter. Right. Yeah. Okay, but you know, obviously you'll get some really easier years, if you will, and some harder years. Yeah.
Iran uses a slightly different lunar calendar, but do they celebrate Ramadan the same as the rest of the world?
Yeah. And the calendar that these kind of observances would be based on would be the same as in other parts of the Muslim world. They also have their particular Persian calendar as well, and so there's it's a sort of a mixture of things there. Ramadan, when Ramadan happens, you kind of have to watch for it. Often newspapers will have a little article about it, but you can know that pretty well all Muslims all around the world are engaging in the fast of Ramadan at the same time. And of course, when it ends, the end of Ramadan is a big festival. Eid al-Fitr, the festival of breaking the fast, and it goes on for 2 or 3 days, and it's festivities, it's gift-giving, it's, again, I use the analogy of Christmas sort of as a In terms of the cultural things we do, not the meaning of Christmas, but the kind of cultural activities of festivity, eating, exchanging gifts, and so on.
Volker, in non-Western countries, would most of the business of living just shift to the night?
In fact, you know, you don't probably, if you're going to go to a Muslim country to do business, don't go during Ramadan. Because people are, during the day, they might not be into work, they're tired, they're probably irritable, they won't, you know, they'll go home early, they'll come late, stuff like that. And at night, of course, well, go for the festivities at night.
That would be one.
But don't go to get something serious done. The last one is Hajj. This is pilgrimage to Mecca. This is required of a Muslim once in their lifetime if they are financially and health-wise able. Okay, so it wasn't a possibility for most Muslims till about this century, or till the past century, the 20th century, don't, because it was just too hard to travel. It was dangerous. You might never come back. Everything. You were not allowed to go on Hajj and endanger your family. You couldn't deprive your children of a father or a mother. You couldn't deprive your children of an inheritance or money to live on. So you had to have all your affairs in order. Your will had to be drawn up, your family affairs in order, finances secure and everything before, and health good enough to undertake the journey before you take the pilgrimage to Mecca. Nowadays, get an airplane, fly over, it's really easy. I know Muslims who have gone on the Hajj several times, starting when they went with their whole family as kids, and then going, you know, for honeymoon Hajj or whatever. it's just amazing, you know. It's really easy to do it now. What that means is that about 2 million people converge on this one city that is pretty small by our standards, and you know, 2,000 people just fly and go by boat and everything into this country all at once. It's the biggest annual gathering of human people in the world. The only thing bigger is the Kumbh Mela, which is a big Hindu festival that happens about every 5 to 11 years in India, where there are about 5 million people come together.
When do people go on the Hajj?
Okay, the Hajj, properly, in order to fulfill this requirement, one goes in the last month of the Islamic year, which is the Hajj month, and during a specific 3 to 5 day period. So all these people come, they have to do it during this particular time.
It's very hard to get a flight in and out of Saudi Arabia.
That's right. Don't go to Saudi Arabia during Hajj for business.
You can't go to Saudi Arabia as a visitor.
You have to be there for business. Yeah, there's no tourism.
There's no tourism.
Yeah.
They're just starting.
Is that right? They're starting now?
That's new.
If you want to know what you do on pilgrimage, basically a pilgrimage rites are based on various rituals that were already in place before Muhammad's time. They were rituals in, you know, sort of what we might call pagan rituals, but they were Islamicized by Muhammad. Muhammad adopted them and gave them an Islamic meaning. They are very closely connected to Abraham. Okay? So here you have the Grand Mosque in Mecca. That little black cube in the middle there is the original mosque. It's a tiny little cube, okay? It's big. It's about 3 stories high, actually. And so you can see it's much bigger than this room. But they built this, the Saudis built this huge mosque around it. This is about the 5th mosque that was built around. And that mosque can hold almost 1 million people on a variety of terraces and on the floor and everything. What people do is they circumambulate the Kaaba. They walk around it counterclockwise. Okay? This Kaaba is believed to have been rebuilt by Abraham and his son Ishmael as a place of worship of God. Then you see that sort of long thing that has Al-Marwa at one end and As-Safa the other, and an arrow. People run back. Those are 2 mountains that are enclosed in this super big mosque. Okay? And people run back and forth. And you know what they're doing? They're reiterating Hagar. Hagar was Abraham's, you know, he had Ishmael by Hagar. It was Sarah's handmaiden, remember? He gave her an Egyptian. And, of course, Sarah got jealous and had Abraham kick Hagar and her son out. And you remember, she was in the desert, and she thought they would die. She was desperate for water. In Islamic tradition, this is very important, they say this is where she ended up. And she ran frantically from between these two hills looking for water until the angel Gabriel appeared to her and a spring welled up out of the water. And there is actually a spring under the Kaaba that pilgrims go to, and they wash things in it and take the bottled water home with them and everything. But they're reiterating Hagar's kind of frantic back and forth movement. Another thing, then they travel outside of Mecca, and I won't go to any of the details, but they eventually end up for one day on the plain of Arafat, and they camp out there, and they overnight, and the next day they spend the majority of the day standing in contemplation in this hot, barren desert that has a little mountain on it. And what they're there to contemplate is Abraham's willingness to sacrifice his son when God required it. Again, I mean, this is a supreme example of submission to God's will. That's and actually without that's you have to do that part of the pilgrimage, or else your pilgrimage is invalid. And then there are some other things. I don't know what our time is like, so I'm kind of concerned that
5 to 5.
So we really have to wrap. Yeah, wrap this up. So there are other things they do as well, but those are sort of the main things. The stuff in the mosque. Maybe I'll just mention the three pillars and Mina. Those represent the devil, because Abraham was tempted by the devil not to follow God's command. And the tradition goes that he threw stones at the devil, and at that the devil ran off. So what people do is they stone the three pillars. Now, again, it's kind of a, you know, we don't think of enacting our faith or training. I mean, they know that they're not really stoning the devil, but just physically doing that action of throwing that stone and kind of like, I reject evil, I oppose the devil, that's the whole thing. And actually they try to get, they gather 49 stones, and you want to stone each of those pillars, a number, at least 7 times each pillar, and then multiple times others. Now, you have 2 million people trying to stone these pillars at the same time. You've got to really be careful. In fact, the Saudis have built several tiers of arcades around each of these pillars, so people are throwing stones from about 3 levels all around them to try to accommodate this huge amount of pilgrims. And then an animal is sacrificed, because what did Abraham do when he got to, no, stop, I know that you're faithful. He sacrificed a ram. And so animals are sacrificed too. The meat is shared. And this is called the festival. This is the other big festival in the Muslim year. It's this festival of the sacrifice. And it's celebrated all around the Muslim world, not just by those who happen to be in Mecca for pilgrimage, but everybody celebrates this with usually a sacrifice of an animal or a slaughter of an animal that's then cooked and shared, like a sheep or a goat or some beef or something, and it's a big celebration again. Yeah?
Do they have something like a Jewish background with kosher?
Yes, yeah. Muslims eat kosher less restrictive than Judaism, though. Like no pork, basically, no alcohol would be the good rule. So if you're having a Muslim over for dinner, don't crack out the wine, and do not please serve pork chops or ham. Yeah.
Do they read the Quran in terms of a cycle?
No, not that I know of, no. There are sort of certain passages which are favorites, and if you go to a Quran school, you might, depending on the teacher, might pick particular chapters, but there's no lectionary. No.
So this time of year, it's got nothing to do with reading?
No. Now, there would be certain passages would be more prominent during certain events because they refer to them. They'd be referring to Hagar or Abraham or something, and they'd be more evident in the pilgrimage time. There's no lectionary that I know. I think we should just, I mean, I'm quite happy to answer more questions, talking. I do have this video of the Hajj, which we didn't use, but that's fine. You know, we can, anybody who's interested in seeing some segment of that, whatever, but I do want to give people the permission, without embarrassment, to be able to leave if they want to and go and eat supper, because I think supper is between 5 and 5:45. It's a buffet.
Just one
chance to eat supper tonight between 5 and 5:45.
Yeah, but it's a buffet.
Right, but yeah. Tomorrow, I don't have a session tomorrow, but on Friday at 6:20, I'm doing a thing on reading the Quran, and I wanted to draw attention to this book, which is in the bookstore. It's called Ishmael Instructs Isaac, An Introduction to the Quran for Bible Readers. And we'll be looking at the story of Cain and Abel, both in Genesis, which we're familiar with, and the Quranic version of that. So if you're interested in that, come. You can even buy this book ahead of time and bone up on it. But I want to let you know this is in the bookstore, as well as this book, Islam, An Introduction for Christians. So if you want to, read more about it, those are available.
Do you think that that's a fairly even-handed presentation?
This one? Yeah, it's very good. Yeah, it's very good. Yeah. It was done by Germans, so it's got to be good.
Thank you, Brett.
Yeah, right.